Welcome to A Million Other Choices. Thank you for joining me. We discuss dark topics here, and sometimes things get hard to listen to. My focus is always on victims and their families and friends, which can be very hard to listen to, so please be advised of this. Ad-free episodes can be signed up for through Red Circle or Patreon, where you can also get access to full-length bonus content. You can make a one-time donation at Buy Me a Coffee. Disclaimer and sales pitch are done. Next up, legal. All sources are publicly available information, and I use a wide variety of sources to try to ensure accuracy, but I cannot confirm the accuracy of publicly reported information. If you would like a specific source or sources, please email me at amillionofthechoices@outlook.com and I will provide it to you. You can also email me there with case suggestions and just general comments. Okay, we are done. Let's get going with what you came here for today.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
I'm covering a case today that's kind of like England's version of the Delphi murders of Libby and Abby, which is one that sits really heavy in my heart for a number of reasons. But this case in particular is very hard. We're going to go through it in a lot of detail, so settle in a little bit because this is probably going to be a long episode. I don't think I'm going to have to do it in two parts, but we'll see. I just don't want to miss out on anything, so I want to do like a deep dive into it. And this is another case that happens in England. It is a place that I have only been to once, and it was very briefly. So if I mispronounce a place or if I get something wrong about how trials like the law or investigations work there, I apologize in advance. The important thing for me is to tell these girls' stories with a deep compassion that I feel for the families and the friends that are left behind to grieve. And so with that, this is the murders of Jessica Chapman and Holly Wells.
I don't remember anything after I left the house until I got to jail.
The law didn't come into my mind. I wasn't caring about the law. I was dealing with dead children on my hands. Fuck the law. I'm in trouble, man. My kids are dead.
But once I lied, I continued to lie. Yes, sir.
Wow.
You know, oh, what a tangled web we weave. But once I told a lie, I had to keep lying.
What kind of person would do
something? I know.
I'm asking you, what kind of person do you think would do something like that?
Obviously, not a good person.
Jessica Amy Chapman was born on September 1st, 1991 to her parents Sharon and Leslie. Her mom worked at the school that Jessica went to, St. Andrew's Primary, and her dad worked for an engineering firm, I'm not sure in what capacity. Jessica was the youngest of three kids. There was Rebecca, who was 7 years older than her, and Allison, 4 years her senior, and then Jessica herself. She was described as bright and vivacious, a little bit of a tomboy. She was very active in sports like swimming, football, like like what Americans would call soccer. And in the summer of 2002, Jessica was preparing to turn 11 and was bestest friends with Holly Wells. Now, Holly Marie was the youngest child of Kevin and Nicola Wells. She had a big brother named Oliver, who was 12 at the time. And Holly was kind of the opposite of Jessica, where Jessica had brown hair. Holly was blonde. She was much more of a girly girl than Jessica was. Holly was starting to get an interest in trying new hairstyles and experimenting with makeup, whereas Jessica wasn't into that kind of stuff, at least not that summer. But they were definitely ride or die best friends. They were pretty much inseparable. Both were really smart girls. They were both doing really well in school. And Kevin had told the UK Mail that Holly would go to bed with a dictionary so that while she was reading Harry Potter books, she could look up words that she didn't know, which is actually something that I remember doing as a kid. I mean, obviously, I didn't read Harry Potter books then, but I do remember having a dictionary near me to always be able to look up words that I didn't know. Jessica's family lived on Brook Street in Soham, England, which is a small town of about, I've heard the population as low as 9,000 and as high as 12,000. So somewhere in there, I believe that in 2002, it was probably closer to 9,000. And today it's probably closer to 12. It's northwest of Cambridge, and Brook Street is about a 10-minute walk from where Holly's family lived, which was in Red House Gardens. So you would pretty much walk up the street or walk up to the end of Brook Street and then turn left. So that summer in late July, Jessica's family had gone, it was summer break, so they had gone on holidays in Menorca, which is owned by the Spanish and it's an island, it's beaches and stuff. And while Jessica was there, she had used some of her spending money to get Holly this necklace that had an H on it, like engraved on it. So on Sunday, August 4th, 2012, Jessica told her mom and dad that she was going to go to Holly's and give her this necklace. Holly's family was having a barbecue that afternoon with like friends and family, which was fine. Jessica was more than welcome to come that day. And so when Jessica arrived, there was another friend of both of theirs there already named Natalie. So the three of them played some video or computer games until just after about 3 PM when Natalie had to go home. Now at 5 o'clock or 5 PM, just before five, they always liked to kind of dress the same when they could. So Holly changed into, she had a Manchester United football shirt and Oliver had one as well. So she gave that one to Jessica to put on. And then Holly's mom took a picture of them in their living room at 5:04. And then from 5:11 until 5:35, there was activity on the Wells family computer. Nothing out of sorts, like there was no chat room activities and there wasn't anything like that. It was just like computer games and like looking at stuff. It's 2002, so this is before Facebook and all of that nonsense. They then ate dinner with the family and friends that were there. And at 6:10, they went back upstairs to Holly's room and changed out of the shorts that they were wearing and into long pants, and then left the house sometime after that, which was estimated to be 6:13, which wasn't a terrible thing for them to do, but they didn't say anything to anyone that they were leaving or where they were going. Now, when I first Googled this, it said that the sun sets in England at 6:31 in August, but that did not sound right to me, even though I don't live there. Because here, obviously, in August, the sun sets at like 9:30 or something. Now, granted, we are in the north. We're much closer to the Arctic, but it just didn't sound right. So I Googled a little harder, and I have come up with an average of about 8:30 that the sun sets there at that time of year, which makes a lot more sense. So my guess, my best guess, is that when they left the house at little after six, it was still light out. Someone will, of course, tell me in the comments if I'm wrong about that. So the best guess or estimate was that they had left because they wanted to go get some candy from one of the vending machines that was at the Sportsplex. Now, this is England, so there is some CCTV cameras. And because it was like a small town, the girls were known in the community. Like Jessica's mom worked for the school She, and of course, Jessica herself was involved in a lot of sports. So they were seen around a lot. So people were familiar with them and knew what they looked like. So they were seen leaving Holly's house and then using the back lane to get onto Sand Street, where they headed up north and then turned left onto Gidney Lane, which is where the Ross Peters Sports Center is. Now, getting to the sports center would have taken only about 4 minutes of walking, and they were seen on cameras crossing the parking lot and then into the building. They entered the gym, and that's where the vending machines are, and that was at 6:18 p.m. They left the building right away after that, and then they crossed the road in front of Soham Village College, which is right next to the sports center. But they're now heading in the opposite direction that they had come from, and heading down Gidley Lane towards College Road. So it appears that they're going for a little bit of a walk. They're probably going to make a loop down Gidney, right onto College Road, right again onto Clay Street, where there's some shops, like there's a grocery store and a cafe and that, and then right back onto Sand again on their way back home or back to Holly's house. So they're kind of doing what they think they're going to be doing is like a square. At 6:24, there was a man named Ian Huntley who lived at the caretaker's cottage next to the college. He was out washing his dog, Sadie, and he saw them passing by. Now, his place is on College Close, so it's just like a little cul-de-sac that kind of deeks off of that Gidley Lane before you turn onto College Street. Ian lived with his girlfriend, Maxine Carr, and she was a volunteer teaching assistant at the girls' school. So they quite liked her and they knew her quite well. And they knew that she had applied for this full-time job in the following fall semester. So they asked Ian how Miss Carr was, and he said, oh, not good. She didn't get the job. And they said something like, oh, that's too bad. Say hi to us, something like that. And then they went up College Street and turned right onto Clay. Now, at the corner of Clay, when Clay becomes, it becomes High Street, but High Street is one of those where if you turn right instead of left and go south on it, it becomes Sand Street again. Like it's, it just kind of blends back into and now becomes Sand Street. Anyways, there's a war memorial there on the corner, and it's called Red Line Square. Now, four people reported seeing them walking up High Street around that 6:30 time frame, and then four more people saw them heading back down Sand Street in the direction of Holly's house about 15 minutes later. So everything is kind of lining up with they went to get some candy, then they went for the short walk, making this square, and then they were headed back home. So at 8 p.m., Nicola, Holly's mom, she goes into her room to tell the girls like it's time to come down and say goodbye to the barbecue guests, but they weren't there. And that was a little bit odd, but she's more like a little bit put off or upset that they didn't say to anybody that they were going anywhere. So she calls Sharon, who's Jessica's mom, and asks if maybe they went over there. Only Jessica's mom is saying, well, no, they were just starting to wonder why she wasn't home yet because it was starting to get late. And by 9:55 p.m., like, which is well after both girls' 8:30 curfew, both the families were in complete panic mode. They were frantic. So they called the police. And the police, and I'm talking about 400 officers, so and not just the police, but also the media, just descended on this little town because, like, this is really disturbing to have two girls walking together. They're doing what they're supposed to do. You know, you're supposed to be safety in numbers. They should be okay when they're together. They know the area. They were familiar with, you know, not talking to strangers and those kinds of things. So this is really disturbing. So the media has come in droves, and not just the local media, like the international media was starting to pick up on the story as well. And so right away, the police are worried that this is an abduction, like some kind of grooming incident where girls, like the girls had been lured by some kind of online chat room ruse, like something like that. Because about a year before that, a 6-year-old girl had been indecently assaulted in Staffordshire by a guy that it was driving around in a stolen Ford. And then a similarly described guy had followed a 12-year-old girl around that same area. And internet grooming was, it certainly wasn't a new concept in the early 2000s, but they were starting to see more and more of it happening. Somebody posing as like a child to befriend an actual child and then luring them to meet. So on August 8th, they've been missing now for 4 days, the police released CCTV footage of the girls asking for tips, and then the parents went on TV to beg for the girls' return, which is, it's just absolutely heartbreaking to listen to.
You love them so much. I just want them home. Just everyone, anyone who's got children must know what we're going through.
So naturally, they do get a lot of tips, like about 2,000 of them. And one of the things that the police were determined to do in this case was not just question every pedo and sex offender in the country, which is about 260 of them. Now, do not get me wrong in any way. I am going to talk about some missteps and errors on the part of the UK police and the justice system there, and the fact that there are, I mean, hundreds of pedos just walking around. But in no way is this story any kind of slight on the UK in particular. I mean, like, come on. I think we're all realistic to know that pedos are a problem everywhere, and every justice system has its issues. The police, of course, they're only human, so they do make mistakes. But I think that it's important to talk about it, not to bash a country and their system and the way they do things, but just to learn from mistakes as they get made. So, and I realize that the UK, I mean, it's the birthplace of Scotland Yard. I mean, they have a pretty good system going there. It's just not perfect.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Anyways, the other thing that they wanted to do was interview every single person in this town, which is like 9,000 people, because they were going to get to the bottom of this. They were going to find these girls. Now, out of these sightings of the girls, there was really only a couple that were, or sort of turned out to be, good, reliable sources, like solid sightings. And that would be Ian Huntley, who lived on College Close. That was at 624, because he actually spoke to them and he was somewhat familiar with them. And then there was a guy named Mark Tuck that said that he saw them around 6:30-ish on Sand Street. Now, Ian, because like I said, he was familiar with the girls and he actually talked to them. But Mark, because he had said to his wife at the time, oh, look, there's two little Beckhams, because of the Manchester United shirts that they were wearing. So he specifically remembered it. But neither was really helpful because they already knew, like at that timeline, that they were still fine. It was sometimes after 6:30 that no one had seen them again. One of the good things that, I mean, I guess it's kind of a good thing when the media descends on a community, is that the media, you've probably seen it in your own community happen, something's going down and they will interview anyone, like the neighbor of a neighbor. And that, again, that can be like a, both a good thing and a bad thing, which was no different in this case. They reported on everything and anything. Like if somebody farted sideways, they were going to be reporting on it.
The spot is about 10 miles from where the two girls disappeared. And for the moment, the army of press from around the world covering the police inquiry are being kept well away.
This is something I'll probably keep for the rest of my life, I think. It's what Holly gave me on the last day of term. She was very, very upset because I didn't get my job. And that's the kind of girl she was. She was just lovely. Really lovely.
That's really very sweet, isn't it?
Yeah.
How do we know they were here at 6:15? Well, we have an eyewitness. Ian Huntley here is a familiar figure. Evening, Ian. You're the school caretaker. The girls, Jessica and Holly, would know you, and they saw you on the front doorstep. What went on?
I don't know the girls. I was still on the front doorstep grooming my dog down. She'd run away and come back a bit of a mess. They just came across and asked how Miss Carr was, as she used to teach them at St Andrews. I just said she weren't very good, as she hadn't got the job. And they just said, please tell her that we're very sorry. and off the walk in the direction of the library over there.
Brilliant, they're kind to everybody. They wouldn't say a bad word about anybody. And they love the families and everything, which is why nobody believes that they would ever run away.
So on August 15th in the morning, the family is full of hope because reports are going out that somebody saw the girls somewhere. But then by that evening, another guy reported finding two freshly dug, what looked like shallow graves. So of course they were sent into an absolute panic. They had to wait all night while the police dug around and investigated that, only to discover it was a couple of badger dens. So I cannot imagine what that, just a roller coaster of emotions would be like for anybody to have that kind of hope. And then no hope, and then hope again. But all this interviewing of people meant that familiar faces to some would wind up on TV. And that would include Maxine Carr and her boyfriend Ian Huntley.
You're the school caretaker. The girls, Jessica and Holly, would know you. And they saw you on the front doorstep. What went on?
I don't know the girls. I stood on the front doorstep grooming my dog down. She'd run away and come back a bit of a mess. They just came across and asked how Miss Carr was, and she used to teach them at St Andrews. I just said she weren't very good, as she hadn't got the job. And they just said, please tell her that we're very sorry. And off they walked in the direction of the library over there.
And you may, as it turned out, have been the last person to actually chat to them before they vanished.
Yeah, that's what it seems like.
And people started to come forward saying that, well, Maxine had mentioned in one of her interviews that she had been in the bath or in the shower or something when the girls had come by, so she missed them. She didn't see them. But these people that were coming forward were saying, actually, she was having drinks in a pub in Grimley right around the time that the girls disappeared. So why would she be saying that she was home? And that Ian guy, well, the only reason he moved there in the first place is because he was kind of running away from rumors that he had kind of a thing for underage girls, and there was a couple of alleged sexual assaults that he had never faced any charges on. Well, the police had already actually searched Ian and Maxine's house. They had done sort of a rudimentary search on the 5th of August, the day after the girls went missing. And they didn't find anything incriminating, but the officer that had come out to the house did notice that there was laundry on the clothesline outside, despite the fact that it had been raining, and the house was in the process of a very deep cleaning. But Ian said that, oh, they'd had this flood in the house, so that was the reason for why they were doing this. And, you know, come to think of it, Ian had been bugging the police quite a bit at the time. He kept asking for updates and had asked a couple of times how long DNA could survive before it was too degraded and couldn't be tested. And over the last couple of weeks, since the girls had disappeared, he was acting a little bit erratic and kind of bizarre, you know, kind of weeping in some interviews and just being weird. But he had also been participating in the searches for girls. And the police do know that a lot of times perpetrators will insert themselves into investigations to usually to find out what's going on. And I don't know, it's some weird thing that people do. Whatever. But he did seem deeply concerned about the girls and compassionate to the families of them. So the police bring both of them in for questioning, but separately. And while they're doing that, they do a search of his house, the college grounds, and his car as well. Now, during the questioning, Ian decided to try and act crazy. Like, he was even drooling at times, refused to answer any questions even about where he was, who he was, anything like that. So they really didn't have much of a choice but to put him under psychological evaluation, which was okay, I guess, because at least they could keep him detained while they finished their searches. Now, Maxine, on the other hand, she blubbered out right away that she had lied as to where she was on that night That she had actually been visiting family in Grimley and hadn't got back to Soham until after about 3 days after the girls had disappeared. That Ian had called her and told her that the girls had gone missing, which she was newsworthy. Like, she just said, oh, that's terrible. But he said, the thing is, Maxine, they came into our house. Now, he was apparently freaked out because the girls had come by that evening. Jessica had this nosebleed, and he had brought her into the house, sat her down on the bed, and tried to staunch the bleeding or get the bleeding under control, and then they had left. And, of course, everybody was going to think that he did something to them because of all of these false assault nonsense that went on before. And he'd also reminded her that he'd actually had a nervous breakdown over all of those allegations, and she didn't want him to be falsely accused again. So she had agreed to say that she was actually home when the girls had come by. And while doing the searches in the house, they encountered a few things that kind of drove their suspicions up, that Maxine and Ian, both the two of them, had abducted the girls and most likely murdered them. Each room of the house had been scrubbed down with some kind of like lemony cleaning fluid. So there wasn't any DNA or blood evidence anywhere, but they did find on the school grounds themselves in some dumpsters both of the girls' Manchester United shirts that had been cut up and burned. Now, fibers on those shirts would later trace back to hair and fiber samples that were taken from both Ian's body and their house and college clothes. His fingerprints were found on the dumpster, which wasn't exactly a smoking gun because, of course, he did work there as a caretaker, but it wasn't really a good look on him, all things considered. Now, his car was searched as well, and they found that it had also been cleaned up pretty good, but there was some traces of like this dust or like chalk that looked like it was from bricks. And one of the back seat covers was missing. The trunk liner had been removed and then replaced with carpeting. It looked like carpeting that you would have in your house somewhere, and it didn't fit very well. So the police arrested both Maxine and Ian under suspicion of kidnapping and murder on the 17th of August. They didn't at that time have a lot of hope that the girls were going to be found alive. And that same day, the police suspicions were confirmed. I guess letting the parents off of this roller coaster of emotions that they'd been on, then plummeting them into darkness and despair. Because around lunchtime, 48-year-old gamekeeper Keith Pryor had noticed a rather unpleasant odor coming from this area near an irrigation ditch along this fence that surrounds the Air Force Base in Suffolk, which is about 10 miles east of Soham. He had actually noticed the smell a couple of days before, but he came back on the 17th with his girlfriend Helen and his other friend Adrian to sort of gingerly investigate, hoping that it wasn't going to be what he kind of feared it was. But just a few yards off of this paved roadway, he saw the girls' remains. They were charred and decomposing. So he called to his girlfriend and said, like, don't come any closer. Let's call the police.
It is with great sadness that I have to tell you the following news. It may be some days yet before we are able to positively identify the two bodies found at Common Drove near Lakenheath in Suffolk yesterday lunchtime. However, we are certain, as we possibly can be tonight, that they are those of Holly and Jessica.
So it would take a couple of days to actually positively identify their remains because of the state that their bodies were in, but they were pretty sure who they had just discovered. Examining the scene, it was pretty obvious that the girls had not actually been killed there, but had been dumped there. They'd been killed in a different location and then dumped. There were hair fibers of Jessica's found on a tree branch that was near their bodies, and the autopsy that had been performed by Dr. David Morris found that both the girls had been partially skeletonized. So he wasn't able to determine their exact cause of death to a certainty, but was pretty sure that it was probably asphyxiation. They also found that the pavement on the roadway that was really near where the bodies were found matched that brick dust that was found in and around Ian's trunk, as well as around the wheel wells of his Ford Fiesta. And when confronted with all of this evidence that was against Ian, Maxine burst into tears and said that no way, he hadn't done it. Like, she continued to write letters to him in prison. She was always asking the prison guards and her lawyers to sort of report back to her on how he was doing. And she never did sever ties with him until well after his trial. Now, before we talk about the trials, I want to tell you a little bit about what I know about these two characters. So Ian Huntley was born in Grimsley, which is in Lincolnshire, which is a neighboring county to Soham. On January 31st, 1974, he was the oldest of, he was the oldest son to Linda and Kevin. He was just a regular working class family. He was a little bit of a mama's boy, afraid of his overbearing father and the usual blah, blah, blah. He was a little bit of a loner, did okay-ish in school. He was bullied as a kid. He was fond of computer games and a fan of the Manchester United soccer team. And as he grew up, he started to have a thing for girls that were younger than him. And because he fancied himself a little bit of a ladies' man, he took care of his appearance. He did have a few girlfriends, but the relationships never lasted more than a few weeks. He finished high school, decided against going to college, and worked a series of odd, somewhat menial jobs. I actually don't like the term menial jobs. I don't think anything is beneath anyone when it comes to work, but I think they mean like manual labor jobs. Anyways, in 1994, he started to date a girl named Claire Evans, who was 18 at the time. So there was only a 2-year age gap, not terrible. They were both working at the time at the Heinz ketchup factory. They got married after only about 2 months of dating. And then within days of getting married, his temper came out and it was pretty evident in the things that he did. He cut off her hair at one point. He repeatedly sexually assaulted her. He once beat her into having a miscarriage. So after this was obviously enough for Claire. She was leaving. And Ian immediately pretended to have this seizure, started drooling. But thankfully, she didn't buy it and she left anyways. Now, apparently she, Claire, later married Ian's younger brother, Wayne. I don't think that matters. I haven't heard anything terrible about the brother Wayne. He's probably fine. So after Claire's departure, he broke into a neighbor's house and stole a bunch of stuff. He did get caught doing that, but they didn't really have any evidence against him. So the charges on the case were kind of dropped, but it did stay on his file that he had been arrested for this. And for the next couple of years or so, he had a few relationships with girls who were, let's just say they were too young for him, for sure. One of them was as young as 13. The other one was 15 and actually got pregnant by Ian. Now, she apparently gave birth in 1998. These relationships were all reported to the police, likely by the girl's parents, but no charges had ever been laid because both of the girls had just kind of refused to admit that they had actually had sex with him. But rumors around Ian and his thing for young girls started to spread throughout Grimsby. And he wasn't exactly well regarded and he faced a lot of insults wherever he went. But it didn't actually really deter his interest in women. He was arrested in 1998 on suspicion of sexual assault of an 18-year-old woman. Now, he, of course, said it was consensual. And wasn't actually charged over it. And then about a week later, another 18-year-old woman came forward accusing him of sexual assault as well. Now, she said that he had not only raped her, but had beat her and threatened to kill her while she had been walking home one night. Now, again, he claimed in that case it was consensual. Now, those charges were dropped because CCTV footage from inside the nightclub, I guess she had been walking home from a nightclub, showed that the two of them had been socializing before in this bar, because meeting some guy in a bar and then leaving means you deserve to be raped by him. I mean, you are asking for it after all, being out in public. I mean, how dare she? So rumors of all of this kind of resulted in Ian getting fired from his job and he couldn't have contact with his baby daughter. And then in July of 1998, police got wind that he actually assaulted an 11-year-old girl the year before and threatened to kill her if she told her mom about it. And for some reason, he never got charged over that, but he does confess to it years later in 2007 for some strange reason. Then in 1999, another woman came forward that Ian had raped her as well. Now, Ian was interviewed about that, but Maxine, who he had just met a little bit earlier than that, gave him an alibi. Now, at that time, his DNA sample was taken, but before any of the test results could come back, the woman said she didn't think it was him, that she didn't pull him out of the lineup. Then in February of 1999, another woman came forward that Ian had her as well. And then in February of 1999, Ian was out at this nightclub in Grimsby and met Maxine Carr, who was actually at the time out drinking with her own boyfriend at the time. But upon meeting Ian, she was immediately smitten with him. And a month later, she moved in with him. Now, Maxine was 22 at the time, but mentally, she was more like probably 17. Maxine had been born Maxine Ann Capp. Also born in Grimsley on February 16th, 1977. Her parents fought a lot, and her mom actually threw her dad out, and he left, but he also didn't pay any support. Like, he basically left and never came back. She was not a very good student, but she still thought that one day she's going to become a teacher. She was also really deeply insecure and had developed a disorder by 16, with plummeted her weight at that point to 84 pounds. In 1993, she'd finished high school and went to work at this fish processing plant that her mom was working at. But she decided to go to the Grimsby Institute of Further and Higher Education. Now, she still talked about wanting to become a teacher, but the new qualifications that she got from this school weren't really all that much. So she went back to this fish plant. She dressed really demurely and acted pretty demurely, but when she would drink, she would get a little bit wild. She would kind of like actually flash people in the bars, and she engaged in a series of a number of one-night stands. But she was really desperate for love. And now she changed her name to Carr sometime around 1995 to not be associated with her father's name anymore. And the relationship between Maxine and Ian, although it had been this whirlwind romance, it would seem, it was both equally passionate on that side as well as on the negative side. Ian was very possessive and abusive. She would leave, sometimes go stay with her mom, but then she would return. Both of them were also not very good at being faithful to each other. So in the summer of 2001, Ian got word from his dad, who was a caretaker in Littleport, that this Soham Village College was looking for a senior caretaker. And so he applied for it with no qualifications or experience, no background check. He was hired. And because he was a senior caretaker, he was able to move into this residence that was on College Close. And so the couple moved in and he started to work at the college in that fall term. And in February of 2002, he found out that the St. Andrews Primary School was looking for, now this was the same school that Jessica and Holly went to, and that Jessica's mom was working at, was looking for this volunteer teaching assistant. Now, obviously she lied on her resume to get the gig, and then this later kind of turned into a paid gig, but it was part-time. Jessica and Holly were actually taught by Maxine, and the girls did really like her. And that July of 2002, she applied for a full-time role there, but she had not gotten the job. And I think it's important to point out that she actually knew that she didn't get the job before August 4th, and she'd already told the girls that she didn't get the job, so they wouldn't have been asking if she got the job. Now, by the night that Holly and Jessica were murdered, the police had Ian's name reported to them on 10 different occasions, and social services had been made aware of his penchant for young girls and sexual violence on 5 occasions. Now, he had never been convicted of anything. He had no criminal record. Never served a day in jail up until that point. And because Ian was busy feigning this insanity, his trial was delayed a little bit, waiting for this forensic psychiatrist to let the court know that he was actually more than ready to stand trial and was faking the whole thing. And although he had been deemed a psychopathic and quote, although Mr. Huntley made clear attempts to appear insane, I have no doubt that the man currently and at the time of the murders was both physically and mentally sound, and therefore, if he is found guilty, carried out the murders, totally aware of his actions, end quote. So now while waiting for his trial to start, he actually took a bunch of pills in 2003, but he survived that. And then about a week later, pled not guilty to two counts of murder, but then guilty to two counts of conspiracy to pervert the course of justice. Now, it sounds like these preliminary hearings were actually held together. So Maxine also pled guilty to attempting to pervert the course of justice and then assisting an offender. The trials for Ian started in November of 2003. It was under Justice Alan Moses. And the Crown prosecutor, who was Richard Latham, he laid out all the evidence against Ian. He said in his opening statement that it was by pure chance that Jessica and Holly had walked by his house that fateful evening and at a time when Maxine was not home, despite the fact that she initially said she had been. The theory was that Ian had lured the girls inside the house. He murdered them shortly after they had entered, shut off Jessica's phone at 6:37, and then Maxine was placed by cell phone records to be in Grimsby at that time, and that, quote, as surely as night follows day, the two had conspired to concoct a false alibi to divert suspicion from Huntley. The lawyer also laid out a bunch of evidence that showed that within about 12 hours of the girls' deaths, he had transported them in the trunk of his car, cut up their clothing, dumped their bodies near that Air Force fence. And then there was also some testimony from a forensic scientist, Helen Davey, who discussed the traces of blood and some saliva that had been found on the girls' clothing, which further linked the girls to Ian. And Ian decided, probably against the advice of his lawyer, Stephen Coward, which is a highly unfortunate name for a criminal defense attorney, to testify on his own behalf, which did not go particularly well for him, and probably made Jessica and Holly's parents want to storm out of the building, cursing a blue streak of rage. Now, if I laugh here, it's not because I find any of this actually funny. It is the pure absurdity of his asshattery that I find just absolutely ridiculous. So his story is that they did come to the house because Jessica was having this nosebleed. So he took the girls into the bathroom to try and stop the bleeding. And the bathtub was already full of water because he had been washing his dog actually in the bathroom earlier and not outside like he originally said. And I don't know why you would leave the water in the bathtub if you're washing your dog and the dog's now clean. You think you'd let the water out, but the tub was still full. So I guess he's keeping the water in there for safekeeping or something. Anyways, he's trying to stop the blood from Jessica's nose and he slipped and accidentally knocked little Holly into the tub. Now, Jessica is screaming at this point, "You pushed her." And he had accidentally suffocated Jessica while trying to stop her from screaming. I mean, that could happen to anybody, I guess. And while he's busy accidentally suffocating Jessica, Holly accidentally drowned. And he panicked and he kind of blacked out. And when he kind of came to his senses or woke up or whatever happens when you black out, it was too late. Both the girls were gone, which is why he didn't bother to call 911. Yeah, but he wasn't done yet with his weird excuses. He said he was not faking being insane when he was arrested and questioned. No, the trauma of witnessing the girls' accidental deaths in his house had caused him to erase his memory and his mind seized up, if you will. Well, 2 days later, it was Maxine's turn to testify about her own asshattery behavior. Now, she says that she had come home on the 6th of August to discover that Ian had stripped the sheets off of the bed and done laundry. Now, she figured the reason he did that is because he had entertained a woman while she was gone. And when she saw that there was this crack in the enamel of the bathtub, she didn't bother to ask about it. And then why did she completely clean the house for him from top to bottom? Well, Ian was a bit of a clean freak. He liked it that way, so she just did it. Now, she had agreed to provide him with an alibi because she didn't want him to be falsely accused of something that she was sure that he would never do. And it's happened before where he's been falsely accused of rape, and she didn't want that for him. Well, then why during her interviews did she refer to the girls in the past tense during these interviews? If she didn't know that they were dead. And she said that that was because she had worked with them in the past, so it just made sense to refer to them in the past tense. She said that she had tried to get Ian to go to the police to be open and transparent about this nosebleed thing, but he didn't want to do that because having the girls in the house was a violation of the school rules, and he didn't want to lose his job. She said, quote, "If for a minute I had known or believed he murdered either of those girls, I would have been horrified," end quote. Now, in his closing arguments, Richard Latham said that Ian, with Maxine's support, had embarked on 12 days of cynical deception, with Carr only revealing the truth to police after being informed of the discovery of the children's bodies. "We invite you to reject the accounts of both deaths being accidental as desperate lies. The only way out for him. We suggest that this whole business in the house was motivated by something sexual, but whatever he initiated plainly went wrong. Therefore, in this ruthless man's mind, both girls had to die in his own selfish self-interest." And then regarding Maxine, he said, "She had the prospect of marriage, a baby, a nice home, and a new start. She preferred to do what she could to make the best of the position she was in that involved at all costs protecting Ian Huntley," end quote. Now, the jury deliberated for 4 days, came back with guilty in all four counts against Ian. Maxine was found guilty of perverting the course of justice because they didn't feel that the prosecution had really proved that she knew that the girls had been murdered. I guess that she had believed his BS story. So she was not guilty of assisting an offender. So she was given only 3.5 years as a sentence, and then Ian was given a life sentence. And the justice, Moses, said at that time, "Your tears have never been for them, only for yourself. In your attempts to escape responsibility in your lies and manipulation, you have increased the suffering of two families. There is no greater task for the criminal justice system than to protect the vulnerable. There are few worse crimes than your murder of these two young girls," end quote. Now, he has to serve a minimum of 40 years, and then he's going to be eligible for parole in 2042. Justice Moses said that the order I make offers little or no hope of the defendant's eventual release. Now, Ian himself said, quote, "I'm going to rot inside this place. I'll rot in here. I know it. I'll spend the rest of my life in here. I'm going to be inside forever. It will be torture," end quote. And I certainly hope it is torture. Now, Leslie Chapman, who's Jessica's dad, said outside the courtroom about the convictions, quote, "I think he was a time bomb waiting to go off, and both our girls were in the wrong place at the wrong time. I hope the next time I see him, it'll be like we saw our daughters, and it'll be in a coffin," end quote. Now, the house that's on College Close, that was torn down in 2004. On September 14th, 2005, Ian was actually burned with some boiling water by another inmate. Now, he tried to sue the prison authorities for that, for failure of their duty of care. It sounds like he was actually successful in that and got about 15,000 pounds and then about 2,500 pounds worth of free legal services for that. On September 5th, 2006, he tried to himself again. And then while he was in the hospital for this overdose of antidepressants, his cell was searched and they found this cassette tape. And this cassette tape contained kind of what was supposed to be, I guess, a deathbed confession. Now, apparently he says that he'd been growing increasingly sexually frustrated with Maxine when some married coworker of his wouldn't sleep with him, and Maxine was away in Grimsby. So he tried to call her in the morning on the 4th of August, but she didn't answer and didn't actually answer him until 6:23 p.m. So right around the time that Jessica and Holly would have been walking past that college campus, And this call had turned into this heated argument because Maxine refused to come home. He said that he had admitted to Maxine that he had murdered the girls when she returned and was planning on confessing, but Maxine had slapped him, told him to pull himself together because she didn't want to lose her teaching job, a job that she didn't even have. And it was Maxine that had told him to get rid of all the evidence and to burn the bodies.
I am so terribly, terribly sorry for what I have done. The people of Soham took me into their community. They trusted me. They gave me a job and a home. And I betrayed that trust in the worst possible way. I'm sorry for the pain that I've caused to the families and friends of Holly and Jessica, for the pain that I've caused my family and friends.
Now, his attempt to unalive himself did not work again. And for some reason in April of 2007, he confessed to the sexual assault of the 11-year-old girl that had happened in 1997, saying that he had dragged her into an orchard. He was then moved to Franklin Prison in 2008. And then in March of 2010, his throat was slashed by another inmate. It was non-life-threatening, though. Now, he did seek damages again from the prison about that. It was about £20,000 he was asking for. But I'm not sure if he was actually successful in that one. Maxine was released on probation in 2004. She had served a total of 21 months. She was given a secret identity and moved to an undisclosed location. She did, however, under the veil of her family, contact this publishing company about writing her autobiography. But after a number of complaints from the public about that, the Mirage Publishing Company declined to publish it. Now, because of the fact that Ian's past indiscretions and crimes had come to light during this trial, there was a public inquest that was held to kind of try and get to the bottom of how he had gotten this job that allowed him access to children and why the police had not sort of pursued him further and earlier on. And after this inquest, the chief of the Humberside Police, David Westwood, was actually fired because he had ordered the records of people that were alleged to be child molesters, but there had not actually been a conviction, destroyed. Now, apparently he later did get his job back, but he retired in 2005. Anyways, probably with a full pension. The chief constable of Cambridgeshire Constabulary, that's a mouthful, Tom Lloyd is his name, also faced some pretty heavy scrutiny because if he had done a proper background check, he would have discovered this outstanding burglary charge that was still on his record from 1995, and he might have actually been denied the job and not living there that particular night that Jessica and Holly decided to go for a walk and get some candy. So this inquiry led to the Independent Safeguarding Authority, which is a national system for police forces to share information. There is now a clear process on keeping records, even when they do not lead to convictions, and the Criminal Records Bureau system, which includes compulsory checks into criminal background checks of people who apply for any work that involves working with children. Now, before I go, I want to read a little bit from this article in the UK Daily Mail that's from 2012, so 10 years after the murders of the two girls. Kevin and Nicola Wells were interviewed, and I find a lot of what they have really, I think, important to share. Quote, "The fact is, some bastard has thrown my daughter in a ditch as though she were a piece of rubbish. But he will not take anything else away from my family. It is time to stand strong. We will not go under. Time doesn't heal. Something got that wrong. It anesthetizes. Grief does not diminish, but you can manage the intensity and learn to live with it. Murder has the capacity to destroy more lives than the one taken. I recognized that from the start, so I try to take control, to make plans, and to exert positive thought. I clung to my family, my community, my work, sometimes to God, and sometimes to the late-night tumbler of whiskey. I chose to believe in the future, a future that I could craft from the life we once had. Really, all I wanted was for us to be the ones who'd make it out the other side. Losing Holly was excruciating, but I have yet to see anything to persuade me that the mother's loss, Nicola's, is not greater. They say 95% of the parents of murdered children split up. We were determined to be among the 5% who survived, but for a year, perhaps 18 months, I couldn't reach my wife. She was lost in a kind of wilderness, whereas I was more hardline about my emotions. I wrote a diary, which was an honest assessment of everything we went through, and it took me to acceptance faster than Nicola. Then I resented her for not catching up. For the first 5 months after Holly died, we broke down together. But after we processed our grief at different speeds, we stopped going to bed at the same time or even sitting down for a meal together. Slowly but surely, we came back together as a couple, thank goodness. Despite us trying to be positive and resourceful, Oliver was extremely withdrawn in the years that followed Holly's murder. Huntley took his childhood and his innocence too. All he knew was that his sister was gone and his parents couldn't necessarily keep him safe. You want to wrap your surviving child in cotton wool after that, but you can't. You can't burden them. There has to be normality. Look, we were a fun family. We are still a fun family. And sometimes it was our sense of humor which kept us going. The failure is that of the police intelligence and of society for permitting Huntley the freedom to prey on children. Today, I accept that there was nothing more or different that as a parent I could have done to change the outcome. About the passage of time when it comes to grief, Kevin said, it gives rise to questions about all that Holly might have been by now. I will never walk a daughter down the aisle, never see her off to another life. She will remain as she was a decade ago. We think about all the things she'll never know, sitting her driver's test, attending her school prom, her 21st birthday. It's a lifetime of loss. One of Holly's closest friends is already a mother, which gives us pause for thought. And it remains the small things, the little things that kind of still get them to this day. It's like the sound of like one of Holly's favorite songs on the radio, or, you know, a mother and a daughter kind of just looking through clothes together. And Nicola, she relayed a story about how she'd sent her passport off to have her daughter's name removed. And she expected that they would reissue the passport. And instead, they returned the original passport, and then they just crossed out, that's terrible, with black felt tip pen, Holly's name. And then there's the photo that she took at 5:04 of the two girls in their Manchester United shirts. She took that photo just a couple hours before they were actually murdered. There's a clock in the background. It just kind of makes like marking that time at 5:04. And so she said of that, the police asked for an up-to-date shot, and here was one that was just hours old. Then it became the symbol of the Soham murders, and it still accompanies stories about Huntley in prison and Maxine Carr having a child. I guess Maxine has a child, which is weird because nobody's supposed to know who she is. It is the last picture of our daughter, yet it represents something evil that is exquisitely painful. We would love to reclaim that image for ourselves. Being unable to do so, I think, is the one last thing we have to deal with. So out of respect to the families of Holly Wells and Jessica Chapman, I have chosen not to use that particular photo in any of my thumbnails, this video, or any promotional material regarding this episode. I think that the Wells and the Chapmans should have the photo of their daughters back. And I'm going to be back again next week with another probably pretty heavy case. In the meantime, feel free to comment, email me, follow me on Instagram. You can like stuff, subscribe to the exclusive content that's on Red Circle if you can afford to do so. And if not, that's okay too. I appreciate you for listening to my weekly rants. And I will be back again next week. And as always, thank you so much for listening.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
I have finally made the leap to Patreon, so now you have some options. You can still sign up for the exclusive feed through Red Circle, which is your best bet if you listen on Apple, because you can just add it then to your favorites feed. That's $5 a month for ad-free episodes, and then there's bonus exclusive episodes that come out twice a month. But if you are on Spotify, you now have the option to sign up through Patreon. That's $3 a month if you just want the ad-free episodes, and then $5 a month if you want both ad-free and the exclusive episodes. Now, if you're already signed up for the exclusive for the $5 a month and you prefer the option of only $3 a month for just the ad-free, you can cancel with the Red Circle at your next renewal and then sign up again under Patreon. And if you did sign up for a year at the time under the Red Circle exclusive feeds, I think it works out that you're actually getting both ad-free and the exclusives for $3 a month, so you should be good.